Welcome back to Midnight in the Mountains. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing fantastic tonight. I think we may get our first snow of the year beginning of next week.
Oh, yeah. I meant to send you pictures. We had snow this weekend and it was beautiful and it lasted for like a day or two. And then I think it was last night we had like 3 inches of rain.
Oh my gosh.
So stuff is in like danger of flooding and the snow is still there. It's still here in some parts where it's like around the trees and on the hills and stuff, the colder spots, but the rest of the areas, it's pretty much gone. Yeah. But now, because like it went up to like 40-ish and now it's like back down, so it's getting cold again. Then we're supposed to get another storm this weekend and I think it's supposed to be rain, but I'm not sure. So, yeah, it would have been nice if it would have stayed all snow, though.
I know. Like, so for us, I think we're supposed to get it either Monday night or Tuesday. But Tuesday, the high here in Tennessee is going to be a blistering 8 degrees for the high.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, Tuesday's quite a few days away. You know, things could change, but it is going to be cold.
That's really cold.
And I think they said the low was going to be like -1 or -2 or something like that.
Oh my gosh. I remember like being a kid and it would drop down to, you know, -6 or -8 or something like that, but not so much anymore.
Past Christmas, but a year ago. It got that cold for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 days. But then it was fine. Like the next day after that, it was like 60 or something. Like Tennessee's weather is very, if you don't like it, just wait a day.
That's really weird. But yeah, anyways. So yeah, I mean, since we last talked, it's been Christmas. It's been New Year's.
Happy New Year's to all our listeners.
Yeah. I hope everybody had a good Christmas. Not to sit and complain, I've literally been sick again.
Like round two.
I've had ear infections. Yeah, like more like 3 or 4. I've had ear infections for like over a straight month and definitely had COVID like last week and I'm still getting better from that.
It's tough.
I'm never this sick.
You know, back, what was it, November, end of October and November, I spent like a month just like, I just couldn't get over being sick. Like, it was just like one thing after another, and ugh. I'm just glad I got mine out of the way so I didn't have to deal with it during the holidays.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly how I feel. It's just like constantly. But either way, yep. I felt good enough to go out this weekend. I did some exploring, did some little adventures to a haunted place. Ooh. So I have that to talk about.
Can't wait to hear that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good one.
So today's episode is going to be kind of some stories that we've, some that I found interesting, some that Laura found interesting, and hopefully you guys find them just as interesting as we do. So my first story is going to be called Saved by the Bell. So if you're my age, you've probably heard of this particular saying where, you know, it just means that the school bell saved you. You know, you were saved by the bell. But the meaning behind this is a lot more morbid. So let's just get right into it. The term saved by the bell originated from a grim reality tied to catalepsy, a condition causing muscle rigidity and unresponsiveness, often mistaken for death. In the past, misdiagnosed catalepsy led to a horrifying incident of people being buried alive. Edgar Allan Poe's eerie tales were inspired by these tragic occurrences. To prevent premature burials, drastic measures were devised. One solution was the creation of waiting mortuaries, where catatonic patients were absorbed for days with provisions in case they woke up. Another macabre method involved testing the deadness of patients by mutilating them or blowing smoke up their rectum, all futile due to the catalepsy's ability to mask pain. Safety coffins emerged in the 18th and 19th century Europe, equipped with bells, poison, glass panes, or keys to escape for those buried alive. The bell-equipped safety coffins became a prevalent solution, leading to the phrase, saved by the bell. However, the effectiveness of these measures in preventing premature burials remain uncertain. The chilling thought of being trapped alive underground persists as a haunting legacy of these dark chapters in history. So I can't say that I can imagine being buried alive. And just the thought knowing there that you were buried alive. It's a very odd thing for a modern person to wrap their heads around this. You know, in the 18th and 19th century, there was no such thing as modern medicine back then. You know, it was a lot of guesses and, you know, they didn't have a good way to tell if somebody was dead or alive. I probably should have looked and see when the stethoscope was invented.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Because you would think that, you know, if they had a stethoscope or you could just put your ear to their chest, like even if they had catalepsy, wouldn't they hear a heartbeat?
I feel like that would be really hard. Like, I think you know, to just put your ear there, you might not be able to hear it. But I just typed in real quick in Google, and it says 1816, there are two versions of the birth of the stethoscope. The first is what is taught today. In the first and more likely version, most sources cite the first use of a tool to be used to hear heartbeats and chest sounds in 1816 by Dr. Theophile Hisenth and Lonneck.
Must be German.
I don't know what that is, but I cannot read that name, and I am sorry. If you're interested in it, just Google it, because, it says it takes the origins back to France in 1860s. So it doesn't seem like, I'm not really sure, but we didn't research it, so.
Well, but that would kind of make sense, though. You know, the 18th century would have been the 1700s. The 19th century would have been the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And so if the modern stethoscope wasn't really invented to the latter part of the 1800s, I could see that being a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we know. So the next one I got, and this one's not really like it's more of a unique story. So I came across this, and it's called The Number Stations. During the Cold War, mysterious radio broadcasts known as number stations emerged, featuring cryptic recitals of numbers or words by unidentified voices, often preceded by odd melodies or tones. These broadcasts, like Nancy Adams Susan or the Linkshire Poacher, captivated listeners and sparked theories about their origins and purpose. Amateur investigators, intrigued by these transmissions, speculated that the eerie broadcasts were covert messages used in espionage. Figures like Rupert Allison, a specialist in espionage, supports this theory, suggesting these stations served as a way for intelligence agencies to communicate with agents in denied areas without conventional means. Despite theories pointing to the espionage, the true intention behind some of these stations remain elusive. One station, the Buzzer, has persisted since the Cold War, broadcasting a series of Russian names and numbers. Initially thought to be Soviet-controlled, its activity increased after the Soviet Union's collapse, deepening the mystery surrounding its origin and purpose, leaving its true story enshrouded in eerie ambiguity. These enigmatic number stations continue to intrigue and baffle listeners to this day. So, as another aside to it, this is not like a regular radio station, per se. Like, you can't use your car to tune into one of these. These are ones that you have to pick up with a ham radio. And there's certain, and if you guys have a ham radio, you can look up the frequencies and supposedly you can hear it. I've never tried it. I don't have a ham radio. But yeah, they supposedly still play today. And they're just, like I said, like either Russian or American, or I think there's even a French one where they just say like weird names and numbers and it repeats 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and some have been going since the 60s. So you're talking, what, roughly 60 years it's been doing that?
Is it, so for some of them, is it the same stuff that's just like on a loop, or is it new numbers and names all the time?
That I'm not sure of. To me, it sounded like it was on a loop, but that it would change occasionally, right? You know, like maybe it would be on a loop for a week, yeah, or something, or, you know, even a month. And then they would, you know, swap it up to something different, was my feeling from it. I guess I probably should have listened to some of them, but because I've heard of this before, the number stations where.
Me too.
But yeah, I thought that was kind of like a kind of a cool story that not a whole lot of people, I think, know about, because ham radios are not very prevalent as they were, you know, back in the 50s and 60s.
Right. I remember listening to Art Bell, and he would always talk about he had a ham radio license, and then other hams would call in and talk to him, which I thought was pretty neat. I think, like, you still need a license to be able to do it.
Yes, because if memory serves me correctly, like, ham radios have the ability to receive and transmit. It's the transmit portion that you have to have the license for.
Okay.
If memory serves me correctly.
I mean, that would make sense. Because, like, you or I could just own a radio and we can receive and listen to stuff, so.
And there are such things as pirate radios. There was a case, let's just say within the last 10 years or somebody, there was somebody in New York City running a pirate radio station on something you could pick up in your car. And the, I believe it was the FCC finally triangulated it down to some guy in his apartment, had all kinds of broadcast gear, and he had been broadcasting for years and years and years before they finally caught him, and he got in big trouble. I mean, it's a big federal thing to use those frequencies without a license.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, like, not something I ever even thought of.
I can't remember what it was. I want to say it was music he was playing, but it may have been talk shows too. It's been too long. I don't remember exactly what he was broadcasting.
But that also reminds me just, oh, I don't know. It might have been like last week or the week before or something. I listened to Hollow Sky podcast with Steve and Kyle. And if you guys haven't listened to their show, go check out their show. Their show's really good. They cover all paranormal, conspiracy theories, everything like this. And they just did a show on this radio numbers channel that you were just talking about, like from ham radio. And they actually play a clip of it because, like, the beginning is like this weird woman's voice. And there was kind of a debate whether it was an AI voice or if it was a real person's voice. And I think people came to the conclusion that it was a real woman's voice. And then it just goes off and it says these like really weird things, like some parts out of the Bible. And then it goes into a series of numbers and stuff. And it was, I don't remember how long of a clip they took. I skipped it because it kind of freaked me out to listen to it. Because I'm like, what am I actually listening to? So I just kind of skipped that part, and then I listened to the rest of their episode. So if you go back to their shows, it's pretty interesting.
Here's something else interesting to think about. You know, in the entire world of 7 billion people, there's probably only like 10 people who know exactly what that means.
Oh my gosh, right?
Maybe 20.
It creeps me out. It could be so nefarious, or it could just be nothing.
Yeah, but it could just be like you know, the U.S. messing with the Russians, like, here on frequency 18,000, we played Adele, or, you know, whatever it was, you know, like this creepy woman's voice with random numbers and letters just thrown out there, and just to, you know, give the Russians something to work on.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Have you ever heard of, I think it's called Max Headroom?
No.
In Chicago. In the, I believe it was the mid 80s, somebody hijacked a television signal and broadcast a video clip. And it was like a very rudimentary computer graphics of a character called Max. And he was saying how all this bad stuff was going to happen. And they actually never caught whoever did that. And to this day, it's still one of the most well-known times that a television station was actually like pirated per se.
Could you imagine? Like, that would have scared the hell out of me. I know it would have.
Well, here's the thing, you know, back in the 80s when this happened, there was no streaming. Everybody watched TV. And you're going to watch the nightly news. Well, I think it was later at night. So you're going to watch the X-Files or whatever station it was. And then this graphic pops up with this cartoon character saying all this stuff. I think it only lasted a few minutes. I don't remember how many. And yeah, I could imagine like the paranoia and the, you know, people being scared. Because imagine your grandmother seeing it. What's going on?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I'd be like this little tiny kid and I'd be horrified and like probably keep me up at night. Oh, they're coming to kill all of us. I don't even know.
I know. Yeah, it's called the Max Headroom Signal Hijacking, and it happened on November 27th of 1987. So it wasn't actually generated computer character. The incident involved a masked person who took over the transmission twice for about 2 minutes, spouting trivia and jokes. The masked person was wearing a Max Headroom mask and costume, and the event is called the Max Headroom Signal Jacking.
That's even worse.
Yep.
Oh, hell no.
If you think about it later on, they have a video of it, and you should probably YouTube it and watch it. It's so weird looking.
No, I'm okay. That would creep me out real bad. Mm-hmm. I'll pass.
All right, so I got, those are mine. Your turn, Laura. Let's see what you got.
Okay, so I am going to go into one of my books for my stories. Now, this one is called Ghost Stories of the Lehigh Valley, and this is one of the books. This book is by Charles J. Adams III and David J. Seibold. And if that sounds familiar, which it might, we have done stories from these books before. Like, they have stuff from mostly Pennsylvania. They do have some books over in New Jersey, things like that. So these are really great because these books are about 30 years old. Some were written, I think, in the late 80s and then early 90s and throughout the 90s. What I like about this is that when you go search stories online, no matter what it is, and especially ghost stories, stuff gets taken away and added throughout the years, so it gets all convoluted. But when you have a 30-year-old book, I mean, I usually tend to trust these stories more than the internet, because these were written at the time they happened or not that far long ago. So driving to the one haunted location that I went to this weekend, on the way there, there is this hill in Palmerton, and it's pretty high. And if you know anything about Palmerton, Pennsylvania, there was a zinc company that came years ago, and the zinc basically poisoned the whole area, killed off all the trees, all the living stuff. And throughout the years, it has regrown. And the top of this hill is basically nothing but stone. There are a few trees. So you can see this house on top of this hill very clear from the road. So I get this book, and I'm going through it, and there's sections where there's pictures in the book, and I come across and I see the house on the hill, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is that house in Palmerton, and I have no idea what it is. So the book says, high on a hill near Palmerton, this highly visible house, probably the best known haunted house in Lehigh Valley. Yet despite its eeriness, there are no known ghostly tales associated with it. Looks, as they say, can be deceiving. If you go through this book, it's kind of written in a weird format because there will be actual stories and chapters, but then at the end of chapters, they'll just kind of add little random ghost stories. The place I went to this weekend was Hawk Mountain, and in the book, the chapter that has Hawk Mountain has a little story at the end of the chapter from the Palmerton House, which I thought was really weird because, like, to get to Hawk Mountain, I would pass the house in Palmerton. So it's just kind of weird. I don't know. It's just like a little synchronicity that I picked up. But anyways, this is what the story says. Does the ghost of a Civil War soldier ride atop his horse near Palmerton? An old story claims that a young woman whose husband had left her to fight dreamed continuously of her wayward lover. One night she dreamed she was swept away by a ghostly form atop a white horse. It was her husband. In the darkness, the soldier cried out, "Brightly shines the moon, swiftly ride the dead." The phantom steed carried the couple to a cemetery where it deposited them at a freshly dug grave. She awoke the next morning and soon was given the bad news her soldier husband had died in battle. So this is where I went to the internet, and I'm going to put these links in the show notes because the one link is kind of like an old newsletter. and it gives all the history on the house, and it was abandoned for some time, and then people have restored it. And it also has the soldier's picture, and his name was actually Elijah Marshall, and the hill is known as Marshall's Hill. And he was in the Civil War. He was born in Seneca Falls near Rochester, New York, and he graduated a second lieutenant from the United States Military Academy at West Point. So he ends up in Pennsylvania, and they had this house built, him and his wife, but from what I read, it was his second wife that he lived there with, because his first wife died shortly after she gave birth to two of their children who had passed away. So I found a local news station that did a story on this, and if you scroll all the way to the bottom of this article, it said that Marshall had one more tragic act to play, this time from the grave. In 2000, his body was taken from the grave and the skull removed. The groundskeeper claimed it was probably taken for a satanic ritual. His headless body was reburied.
What?
Yeah. I don't even know what to think on that one. I'm like, is that true? Was there really some kind of ritual that was done?
That sounds like somebody did that for a purpose, for sure. Like, why would you just take the skull of a guy that's been dead for, what, 100 years? 120 years?
Wonder if it had something to do with that he was, like, a soldier or I don't know what.
I find it hard to believe that a bunch of teenagers in the middle of Pennsylvania decided to dig up a Civil War soldier, steal his head. But, I laugh about it. It's a serious thing, but it just, like, the imagery going through my head is just, like, very weird.
So that's what I have for that one. Then I'm going to let you go into your other one, and then I'll wrap everything up. And
yeah. So my next one, before anybody listens to it, this one is pretty dark. Doesn't show a very good light on some of the prison systems in America. But this one's called the Tucker Telephone. The Tucker Telephone has a disturbing history entwined with psychological manipulation and torture. Initially associated with Dr. Ewan Cameron's experiments aimed at erasing memories and identities at Montreal's Allen Memorial Institute, this device administered electric shocks through electrodes attached to patients' temples, inducing extreme discomfort and pain. Patients endured fear and agony, confusion during these experiments, highlighting the Tucker Telephone's role in breaking down individuals' sense of self. These procedures, part of psychic driving, inflicted profound emotional and psychological trauma on the subjects. Beyond the clinical setting, the Tucker Telephone became synonymous with brutality within the penal system. At the Tucker State Prison Farm in Arkansas during the 1960s, it was used as a sadistic method of punishment. Designed by Dr. A.E. Rollins and prison superintendent Jim Bruton, this device was an electric shock instrument affixed to prisoners' private parts. Victims were strapped down and electricity coursed through wires connected to their skin, leading to excruciating shock that often caused permanent organ damage and mental distress. The horror didn't end there. The device's legacy extended beyond Arkansas. It was reportedly used for torture by the Chicago Violent Crime Unit in the 1980s and by American interrogators abroad. The Tucker Telephone represents a stark example of the ethical boundaries violated in the pursuit of knowledge and power, serving as a haunting reminder of the darkest aspects of the psychological research and systematic abuse within the penal system. If you saw a picture, which I'll send you the picture of it, this thing looks like it doesn't look scary at all. It looks like an old-timey telephone is what it looks like when I saw it. It is the most tame-looking device you've ever saw. It looks like, I'll tell you a better one. It almost looks like an old-school alarm clock. Like, it had the two bells with the buzzer on it. But yeah, I read across this one in a scary story. Not like horror story, but like a scary story section about the Tucker Telephone. And I went through and looked at it. And I don't think there's much more to add to it. I mean, it sounds absolutely horrendous, and I can't imagine how prisoners, even people in jail, were subjugated to this particular type of torture in America.
How long ago did you say that was?
back in the 60s, and then it went all the way up to reportedly in the 80s, in the 1980s.
Jesus, I'm thinking like, you know, well, a long time ago, but I mean, you know, like, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just think about the 1960s. I mean, that was still, to be fair, 60 years ago. That is kind of a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it just kind of gives you a some perspective on how different the world was in respect to how we think about other people from that point to now. I think so.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I didn't think I heard of it. But then after you explained it a little bit, and I feel like I heard about that a long time ago, but I didn't realize that it was as recent as the 1960s.
Yeah. Yep. It's pretty scary for sure. And I'm sure, you know, and the sad part is there's probably people out there in the world who were intimately familiar with the Tucker telephone. Because think about it. If it was used in the 80s, I was born in 1980. You know, if they were born in the 60s and they were in prison in their, you know, their 20s, they absolutely could know what the Tucker telephone is.
That's horrifying. That really is.
Yep.
Way to ruin the rest of your life.
Over. Yeah. Yeah. So I have one more story, but I think you have one as well.
Yep. Just goes to show, which I mean, when we get into our next story, this one's really gruesome too. And I mean, it goes to show that humans are scarier than any kind of ghosts that could possibly be.
I mean, humans are scarier than any type of animal, to be fair.
I definitely agree. But okay, so like I said, on my trip to Hawk Mountain, I went through Palmerton and I saw that house up on the hill. And I'm going to start by reading part of this chapter. I'm not going to read the whole thing. And it's titled, The Ghost of Hawk Mountain. No place in the greater Lehigh Valley can boast more natural beauty than lofty peaks of Hawk Mountain. Although the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary is a premier nature center and world-renowned refuge for birds of prey, straddles Berks and Schuylkill counties, it is situated just over the Lehigh Valley county line, and indeed the impact of the ghostly tales which emanate from the wooded depths stretches well beyond its boundaries. While Hawk Mountain and the valleys which spread before it is certainly a showplace of natural splendor, it is also abundant in wild and chilling stories of the supernatural. It is quite simply one of the most haunted areas in the United States of America. This is no idle boast. In fact, those who live and work on the mountain certainly wish it were not so blessed or cursed with the level of activity, the spiral of energy which swirls throughout the trees, trails, rocks, and ridges. I don't want to believe too strongly in this stuff, says sanctuary curator Jim Brett, because I never want to leave this wonderful mountain. So now, side note, what they're talking about is there's Hawk Mountain Sanctuary on top of this mountain. Like, you can go there, you can pay money to hike on the trails, and it's known for being like an area where there's tons of different kinds of birds, eagles, vultures, all that stuff. So from what I'm understanding is that Jim Brett was the curator of this sanctuary. So now, okay, I'm going to go back to reading now. The stuff to which the hardy man of the mountain refers to are the many confirmed and documented encounters many people have had with the phantoms that stalk that wonderful mountain. The legends of Hawk Mountain are rooted deeply in the distant times before the first white man set foot on the rock-strewn slopes of the Forbidding Hill. What the natives who populated the region centuries ago might have called the mountain has been lost in time and translations. What they felt about it, however, is fairly well researched. To the Lenni Lenape Indians, it has harbored a certain sanctity. Nudging higher than the hills around it, it was close to their gods, therefore it was the site of ceremonies and rituals. Archaeological evidence has been found to verify this, and the deep attachment the Indians had to the mountain may well have been the spiritual spark which ignited the almost demonic flames which cast their frightening glow on all those who seek the Hawk Mountain, which is somewhere beyond the realm of the known. What is known about the earliest recorded history of what is now called Hawk Mountain is that the site of the tragedy in 1756, a tragedy which is the first link to it in a chain of bizarre incidents which pepper the history of the hill. Okay, so now I'm going to stop real quick. I'm going to add in my two cents, which is this book was written 30 years ago. I'm always very careful to say Native Americans. I don't want to say Indians because I don't want to insult anybody. So just know that when I'm saying Indians, I'm not trying to insult anybody. This is just how this book is written, and that's just how I'm reading it. Some of this stuff is really gruesome. Just prepare yourself for that. As white settlers ventured into the foothills of the Blue Mountains in the 18th century, the natives tried to tolerate the incursion. Treaties were made, treaties were broken, and that tolerance was weakened as the Indians were forced deeper into the forest away from fertile soil of the valleys. Determined to conquer what was then the American frontier, the settlers built a chain of forts along the base of the mountains through Berks, Lehigh, and Northampton counties, and sought to protect the homesteaders. The Indians' frustrations built to a fever's pitch, and attack followed attack in farmhouses across the lowlands. The historical references of Indian raids and the area are simple but sobering as recorded. A brief sampling of this. So now, I believe this is something that would have been in a newspaper or something, because they changed the font in the book so that you know that it's something different. And this one is February 1756, George Zyloff and wife, two boys and girl, murdered. June 1757, Adam Trump found with a knife and a spear fixed to a pole 4 feet long in his body. July 1757, Martin Yeager and his wife, murdered. Abraham Schleckler's wife and a child of Adam Claus were scalped at the same time. 1757, a man shot in bed whilst sick. One of the most gruesome attacks to take place on or near Hawk Mountain was in 1756. In February of that year, all but one member of the Gerhardt family was slaughtered by Indians. The only survivor, 11-year-old Jacob, watched from the behind nearby bushes as his father was called out the family's small cabin and was hacked to death. The home was set ablaze, and Jacob watched in horror as his mother and five brothers and sisters were incinerated. A mature Jacob Gerhardt returned to the mountain in 1793 after a permanent peace with the Indians had been established. He built a more substantial cottage near the top of the 1,500-foot mountain, and property remained in his and his heirs' names for six decades. The next property owners of record were George and Priscilla Bollock, who resided there for 52 years, eventually selling the land to Margaret and Matthias Schambacher. It is the Schambacher area in which history and mystery begin to mingle on Hawk Mountain. Matthias Schambacher, or Schambach, as it is spelled in some references, transformed the old Gerhardt stone home into a kind of wayside tavern, making and selling Applejack and Blue Mountain tea to travelers who used the road over the mountain as a crude, steep shortcut to the lower coal regions to the Lehigh Valley. Most of the travelers included peddlers and delivery men who would be anxious to stop at Schambacher's tavern for a refreshment. Abstemiously, they would pull up, secure their horses and carriages, amble into Matthias' place, have a drink or two, and be on their way. The trouble is, some of them never made it to where they were heading. One by one, men disappeared from that lonely road up over the mountain. The last place they could possibly have been seen would have been Schambacher's tavern. Two, then four, then eight, then a dozen. These wagon drivers simply vanished without a trace. That is until something very strange happened. It's recorded that Matthias Schambacher was seen wearing and selling surplus and used Civil War uniforms just weeks after a Civil War uniform peddler was reported missing somewhere between Kempton and Orangeburg. Suspicions began to mount that Schambacher may have waylaid the man and stolen his cargo, but there was only scant evidence. Local residents attempted to question the gruff Schambacher, but they were repelled as they approached his property. Weird reports circulated the Lehigh Valley below. Some folks told of globs of blood on the dirt road between Schambacher's house and barn. Some told of mournful moaning sounds coming from the basement of the house. Some told of unexplainable wagon parts hidden near the small barnyards at Schambacher's. But there was no firm evidence which would link the man what had become suspected murders. Schambacher had never been a popular man. Local children were warned to steer clear of him. His secrets were many. The gravest secrets of all were eventually revealed to a startled but somewhat expectant citizenry of Matthias Schambacher's lay dying. Nearly everyone for miles around had become convinced that Schambacher had a hand in the disappearances and assumed deaths of the men. Thus, it was a grim task for local minister who was beckoned to Schambacher's side in early March 1879. Word had gotten to the pastor that Margaret Schambacher had requested his presence because her husband's condition had worsened, and he had told her he had something to confess. Even the most thorough and compassionate psychological and theological training that minister could have received could not have prepared him for what he was to hear from the lips of the dying man. The tales told and retold on this mountain say the conversation went something like this. Matthias, why do you call me here? Because in whatever time I have left on this earth, I must confess my sins. And what sins may they be, Matthias? I have taken the lives of men. Men, you say? How many? I know not. I cannot remember. I lost count at 14, for only 14 skulls would fit in my well. A shocked pastor gulped and regained his composure and continued. And Matthias, how did you kill these men? With my axe. And how, where did you dispose of the remains? I stripped the flesh from the bones and placed the bones on the rocks for the beasts of the forest to pick clean. As for the flesh, there is wide and horrid speculation as to how it was used. In the most grisly speculation of all, it is said that after Matthias Schambacher claimed his first victim, he added fresh sausage to his tavern's menu. This is only speculation, mind you, but it is the stuff of legend, and no legend anywhere is more gruesome than the legend of Hawk Mountain and the role Matthias Schambacher played in it.
That is quite the story.
There's more to it. There's a few more pages here, but I'm not going to read all of them. They are interesting, but it's said that when he was buried, in New Bethel Church near Kempton, and that church is still there today. I also went there this weekend when I was out. It's said that when he was laid to rest, it is recorded that Schambacher's coffin was being lowered into the grave. The somber trio was startled as thunder rumbled in the distance, their attention turned to Hawk Mountain. The Hulk of which formed a wooden wall to the west. As they cowered in fear and disbelief, deep gray and black clouds tumbled over the mountain, spinning and surging in their direction. The roar of the thunder was insistent. There was roar of thunder, the sky darkened, and casting an eeriness across the graveyard at once with no warning whatsoever, a spear of lightning crashed from the clouds and struck Matthias's Schambacher's fresh grave. Thunder clapped and shook the horrified funeral party to their souls. Another crack, another flash, another bolt of lightning seemed to take aim on the grave. The three fled for safety, too scared to rationalize what happened. And it said that the storm subsided right after that. So that is the story of him, but it's not the end of the weird stuff that goes on at the mountain.
I think that's a place that I need to visit at some point because it sounds super interesting. I mean, can you talk about a little bit, like what you thought about it?
Yeah. So the graveyard is supposedly haunted, and it's not just the Schambacher legend that haunts it, but it is said that an old farmer was driving past the cemetery, and he noticed a well-dressed old man walking slowly with slumped shoulders and a downcast head in his direction. And he, as he drove past, he went to look at him, and he turned around to look, and the guy was gone. So there's other things with the cemetery that I went there trying to find his grave. And in trying to find the grave, I could not find it. So I'm, you know, on the internet looking at stuff. And in the meantime, I found that in that cemetery, there's supposedly a woman who is in mourning attire, and she is walking to a grave to mourn the loss of her loved one. And it's not, they don't know which grave that she was walking to. And then it's also on a hill. So it's said that there's this little girl ghost that is seen by a prominent gravestone up on the hill, kind of just like running around up there. And I took a bunch of pictures because there's a few gravestones that are actually rather large. So, I mean, I would consider them prominent gravestones. So it's really hard to say which one is what she's seen by. And then I also, doing a little more research, I found out that they had actually taken Schambacher's gravestone out of the cemetery because it was causing too much of an issue.
Oh, really? Now that's really interesting.
Yeah, like people were like pissed about it, and they wanted to not have people come and destroy stuff in the graveyard, so they took it out. And actually, it was weird because there was a picture online of where this gravestone was, and I had walked into the cemetery, and I'm standing there, and I'm like, I feel like I'm right on top of the grave, but like I'm not seeing it. And I'm trying to compare my photo to what I'm seeing in real life. And it actually turned out that it was pretty much right behind me, if that is the correct gravestone, because online it shows basically just like the formation of where you would stick a gravestone, and that's it. Like, it's just completely taken out of the ground, and there's just the formation is left there.
Out of curiosity, when did they move his grave? Was it like recently, or was it like way back when?
You know what? I don't know.
Oh,
I actually don't know when it was moved. But what they did was, and I think this was somewhat recent because it's on the internet, the picture of, you know, there being no headstone there and it's just flat. So I went there and I found this spot, and I'm like, there's actually a headstone of somebody else, and it's like almost like cut off at the bottom and smacked on top.
Well, that's of weird.
Where his grave marker supposedly is. So it's like they took somebody else's headstone and put it on top of where his is to cause all this confusion so people couldn't find him. Which is just weird because they took somebody else's headstone and smacked it on top of where his grave supposedly is.
That's kind of odd.
And I'm only assuming this because I can't say for sure that I know that the internet's right and the picture is correct. Because if you look it up, it says section 1, row 1 of the cemetery. And it would make sense because there's more modern graves on the one side of the cemetery. And then on the other side, it's, you know, it's all back into the 17, 1800s it goes to.
Right. That makes sense.
So there's that, which was pretty neat. And I mean, the church is very pretty, and I walked up on the hill, and you can see Hawk Mountain from the cemetery, and it is a really pretty spot. But I mean, along with Hawk Mountain, there's also some other messed up hauntings that go along there. Now, the tavern, Schambacher's Tavern, is still there today, but it is a private residence. So I will say, you know, if you go there, if you check it out, please do not bother them. It is their home. So just observe it respectfully. But it does say on the mailbox, Schambacher's Tavern. I took pictures so that like I can send it to you, and I'll post it on Instagram. And it said that there was this little girl that lived there in the house, and supposedly she was deaf and mute, but she would play a flute for her mom, and she fell down the steps and died. So supposedly she haunts the tavern, and you can hear her playing the flute from in the tavern. And then there's also stuff where, like, people said that they've still heard screaming and moaning outside of the tavern, like the people that were murdered there by Schambacher.
Right, right.
And it also says that light switches have been seen flicking up and down. Water turns on and off. Here says in the book here, a bed vibrating and levitating, strange beams of light extending from the floor to ceiling. The conversations, the sound of the penny whistle. I'm sorry, it wasn't a flute. This is a penny whistle, which I guess is very similar to a flute, you know.
Yeah, just smaller.
Yeah, and footsteps can be heard. And then it's also said that outside the building, there's like a stone wall, and back there can be seen a silvery glow, and a dim light will appear and reappear in the upper floor window, and then ghostly images form in the side yard near the vicinity of an old persimmon tree near where it said Schambacher buried one or more of his victims. There's also been stuff seen, like this very large glowing humanoid figure up to about 10 feet tall has been seen walking on the road up there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then there's also stuff where a great white ghost bird has been seen. People go up there to watch the birds. So it says that it's even unidentifiable by veteran bird watchers. So there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on there.
A very spooky place.
Yeah. I've also seen online where it said that you can see like glowing orbs on the mountain. There's glowing orbs in the cemetery. I really want to take a trip back there and go at night and kind of just like drive around and hang out a little bit and see if there's anything. I also thought about getting some like dowsing rods, or maybe even bringing a recorder to see if you could get any EVPs, because when you go up there, before you reach the top of the mountain where you can go to the sanctuary, the Appalachian Trail also runs through it. And there is an AT shelter that's like right there, you know, not that far in from the road. And you can actually see the Schambacher's Tavern from that AT shelter. So you could totally just, I mean, you could sit there and just see if you're experiencing anything weird in that area. And I'm also going to put a link in the show notes to the Wandering Woodsman YouTube video, because he went up there and he tells the story from the AT shelter that's right across the road. And if you're not familiar with the Wandering Woodsman, he's really awesome. He goes hiking, he tells local folklore and history and things like that throughout Pennsylvania. Sometimes he goes to other places, but his stuff is really good. And he's very like educational. He does his research and stuff. So I highly recommend going to look at that if you're interested.
I have a thought. This is kind of tangent, but you know, the people that bought Schumacher's Tavern, do you think they knew it was the history behind it before they bought it? Or you think they were just like, oh, that's a really nice, cool old place?
Oh my gosh, I don't know.
Could you imagine?
I feel like you'd have to know. And if they don't know, they definitely have to know by now.
You think that previous owner stole it, they were like, well, there's some history behind it, but like they don't tell the whole history, and the people buy it and they're like, well, maybe we should look it up. And there's like this huge list of murders that happened at their place, and like all this weird stuff is happening. It always makes me wonder about stuff like that. Like, did they buy it because it was haunted?
Right.
Or were they one of the, you know, people that were like, oh, what have we done?
Yeah, I would feel really bad if it was that one because I mean, there's like certain states that you don't have to disclose if there was murders in the house.
And to be fair, the murders happened 200 years ago. That he probably, even with states that did have to disclose it, I'm pretty sure there's a statute of limitations on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. But my God, could you imagine? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to know it by now. There's no, like, how could you not have heard of that?
I'm sure the locals, like, if they were from out of town or something like that, I'm sure some though the locals said, "Hey, you realize what you bought?"
Yeah, I know I wouldn't want to live there. I mean, whether there's paranormal activity or not, I still wouldn't want to live there. Because, I mean, I'm sure there's no way. Like, I've been to a handful of haunted places now, and when there's stuff that's traumatic, I mean, that energy stays there. I wouldn't want to be there.
I mean, to be fair, I don't think I'd want to stay anywhere near Hawk Mountain. It just sounds quite terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would definitely like to see some of the light orbs. And I mean, could you imagine seeing like a 10-foot tall glowing figure walking on the road?
Well, yeah, seeing all the birds would be pretty cool too. You know, I tend to like, you know, bald eagles, chicken hawks. It'd be kind of fun. You know, if we didn't see anything else, the birds would still be cool.
Once it gets warmer, I'm definitely going to go back up there and go hiking because there is a scenic overlook on one of the trails. But, I mean, the trails are really rocky up there, so when I was there, there's no way I was going to go because it was snowy and slippery and gross.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, all right, so I think I have one more story for you guys. And that was a really good story, Laura. That was really interesting, you know, to hear about one of your local places.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about the place, but I never knew that it had such a bad history to it until my sister gave me a Haunted Pennsylvania book last year for my birthday or something like that. And then I read it. And then I got this other ghost book, and it has the story in there also. And I started doing research online, and I was like, wow, that's a place that's on my list that I want to go to. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah. One more side note. I traveled to Kansas City for Christmas this year. And I went right by the exit for the Bell Witch.
Wow.
Caverns. Yeah. I saw the sign for it. I was like, oh, that's where it is. Huh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. You should took a little. Well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of on a time crunch for that one. But it's literally probably less than an hour from my house.
Cool.
Give or take. Yeah. So. Summer trip up to the Bell Witch Caverns. Yeah,
there's a whole thing on that too, where it's like, you know, it's all just folklore, kind of like made up stuff. And then I've heard some other stuff where I'm like, that sounds pretty legit. But I mean, regardless, I'd still want to go.
Oh, it'd be cool. So, anyways, so my last story is it's about Old Red Tom, which I'd never heard of before. And the story kind of goes like this. A man recounted a remarkable and chilling experience from his time in Vietnam during the 1960s. He was assigned to a mission deep in the jungle with a small team, and they were deploying seismic ground sensors when a surreal encounter unfolded. Separated from the main group, this man observed a peculiar sight. A light-skinned black Union cavalry soldier resembling his great-great-grandfather positioned near a trail intersection. In a moment of disbelief and astonishment, the spectral figure signaled for silence, gesturing for him and his team to stay hidden. Following the soldier's guidance, they retreated into the cover of the jungle just in time. Within seconds, a sizable contingent of the North Vietnamese Army soldiers passed through the intersection, heavily armed and capable of devastating his team had they been discovered. Realizing their miraculous escape, the man and his team quietly regrouped with the patrol, keeping the encounter with the Union soldier a secret for many years. Only much later in his life did he disclose the extraordinary event, sharing it with his grandmother. Her knowing the reference to Old Red Tom, which was her great-grandfather, and he is a remarkable figure with a history of service in the Union Army and U.S. Cavalry, and he was known for his distinct armament, added a layer of ancestral significance to the mysterious encounter in the Vietnamese jungle. So I wanted to look and see if this story, if Old Red Tom was like an actual person. So here's what I found about Old Red Tom. Old Red Tom refers to a remarkable figure from history, a black Union cavalry soldier known for his significant contributions during the American Civil War and his service in the American West. Old Red Tom, also known as Thomas Franklin, was a man of mixed heritage, half black and half Creek Indian. He played a notable role as a scout for the Union Army during the Civil War. His reputation stemmed from his remarkable skills, bravery, and strategic abilities as a scout. He was recognized for his proficiency in navigating terrains and providing crucial intelligence to Union forces. Red Tom was respected for his courage and dedication to the Union cause and often venturing into perilous territories to gather vital information. He was also known for his distinct armament, carrying two pistols, a Spencer rifle, and a Creek war club into battle. This unique combination of weapons showcased his versatility and resourcefulness in combat situations. After the Civil War, Old Red Tom continued his service, joining the United States Cavalry in the American West. His experiences and skills as a scout likely proved invaluable in the challenging landscapes of the frontier. His legacy as a courageous and resourceful soldier persisted through generations, and his story was passed down through family histories and tales. The account of Old Red Tom holds significance in recognizing the often overlooked roles and contribution of Black soldiers in pivotal moments in American history, shedding light on their bravery and resilience in the face of adversity. So I thought this one was kind of fun. The website I got this off of, it was just a list of a bunch of stories, and this is the most modern one they had on there. And since I'd never heard about it, I thought this one was kind of interesting, you know, to see a Union soldier from the 1860s in the Vietnam jungle 100 years later, and it happened to be his great-great-grandfather.
I really like that story. I didn't know the name of it, but I swear I've heard that story before, where the grandfather came and was like, no, get down, and like protected them.
I feel like I heard about one of those, but it was in like World War II or something.
Okay.
Or maybe even more like World War I, or it was in Europe. It wasn't in, you know, Asia. But yeah, I saw it and I thought, that'd be a fun one to share.
Yeah, I like that story a lot. I have a slight side note to add to that. I was thinking of it while you were telling your story. I know someone who went out to Triangle Field in Gettysburg, and that's supposed to be a very bloody spot. And he was walking, and all of a sudden he gets pushed down and thrown to the ground. And he's like, what the hell? And it scared the shit out of him. And I guess he had talked to someone who was a medium. And I think she went with him the next time he went to the field. And a spirit had come up to her. And she talked to them and said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare him, but I was just trying to get him to duck down to get out of the way of gunfire. So here's this story that I had heard firsthand by somebody I know that went to Gettysburg and got shoved by a ghost soldier that was trying to protect him to get down from gunfire.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Oh, that's super interesting.
Yeah, that just goes off on a whole other branches of time is all going on at the same time and all this other stuff. But
yeah, that ghost is stuck in a particular portion right. of time. Even though things have moved on, they still do the same thing over and over and over again. Like,
right.
Like a Groundhog's Day, kind of.
Yeah.
But for ghosts. Good movie, by the way. If you haven't saw Groundhog's Day, it's an older one. Definitely checks out.
I've never seen that.
What?
Yeah. Maybe Laura, I should watch it.
You have to go. You know, just remember that it was filmed back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like, it's definitely an 80s movie. But yeah, it's a classic.
I'm going to watch it. I'll report back.
Next time.
Mm-hmm.
Movie critic Laura.
Yeah. All right, guys. So that wraps it up. Hopefully you found something that we said interesting. And as always, our links are in the show notes. I'm going to put some links to the stuff that I talked about. I'm going to put pictures that I took and pictures from the book on our Instagram account, midnight_in_the_mountains. And if you would like to send us a true paranormal story, we'll keep it anonymous if you wish to do so. We will read it on the show, midnight_in_the_mountains@yahoo.com. And that's all I have for you guys.
I still wonder, has anybody sent any bowl cut hair pictures yet? So sad about that.
I'm sorry. If somebody does, I'll be screaming and I'll be sending it to you ASAP.
All right, everybody. Thank you for a good episode, and we'll see you guys shortly.
Bye.